Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support. 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way, so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code ACAST to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all of my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I am just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. So I am here with Paige Pritchard. I first heard of Paige on the Financial Confessions podcast, and I was really impressed by her understanding of why people overspend. She's all about overcoming overspending without telling you that it's all about just stopping going to Starbucks. Instead, her approach involves looking at why people spend money in problematic ways and understanding what's really going on underneath as a way to address that overspending. She is a money coach, the owner of the Overcoming Overspending community, and she's the host of the Money Love podcast. Paige, how are you?
I'm doing so good. I am just thrilled to be here with you to have this conversation today. I'm really excited. I think the work that you do is so, so important. So I'm just really happy to be here.
Thank you. And thank you for coming on. As soon as I heard you on that podcast, I was like, yep, yes, please.
Yeah, I feel you. I feel you. We do things, you know, obviously, I know you and I talk about different things, but they're obviously so closely related, right? So happy to be here.
There's a lot of crossover. So that we're all clear what we're talking about, can we start? How would you define overspending?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. You know, in my world, I think that I define it a little differently than how most people think about it, because I think when you hear the word overspending, what most people think of is they think, I'm just spending either more money than I have available to me, meaning I'm going into debt, or I'm spending more than I planned to spend, which, yes, of course, like those two things absolutely meet my definition as well. But, you know, my brand is called Overcoming Overspending. So in my world, how I personally define overspending is really any spending that you're doing that is against your own good. So sometimes that means you're spending more than you have or you're going into debt, but it could also look like, you know, you're using shopping or buying as an emotional crutch. It could mean that you're buying a bunch of things that you're not getting a lot of use or a lot of value out of. So really it's just any type of actions that you're taking with your money in terms of spending it, buying things that hurts you, that just isn't to your benefit, that's against your own good. So, and that looks like a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
It does. I think my instant thought when I hear about overspending is big, extravagant purchases. Mm-hmm. Somebody going and buying all kinds of designer things or a big car, something like that. Whereas for me, I think at the times I fall into this trap, it's lots of little extras that I think don't matter because, oh, it only costs £3. I don't need to even think about that. But if you spend enough £3, £5, £2, £10, you know, it adds up to a lot more. And so what are some ways that people can spot that they might be overspending? I think we know if the credit card bill is big or if we go overdrawn, but what are some other ways to spot signs of it in ourselves?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're absolutely right. I just want to kind of reiterate what you said, right? Because I see that a lot in my community as well, where it's not necessarily like these big extravagant purchases. It's kind of what I call like the death by a thousand cuts situation, where it's like, oh, it's not that much, like do, just kind of going about your day. And then before you know it, you're like, whoa, like where'd all my money go, right? So super common. Just want to kind of reiterate what you were saying there. But some ways to kind of see like, okay, is this becoming a problem for me? Am I overspending? I think that you have like the most obvious ways. And I say that typically what kind of wakes people up initially to this problem is the financial implications of this. So obviously, like you're overdrafting your account, you can't pay your credit card off in full. You have revolving debt that you're paying high interest on. Late fees, overdraft fees, that sort of thing, right? But where I kind of like to go is to dive a little bit deeper to say, okay, is this starting to impact other non-financial areas of your life? So a couple of, you know, major areas that I see a lot. One is, how much of your time are you spending? Like your time is something that we typically don't think about a lot in terms of, you know, shopping and buying and acquiring. But at least for the women that I work with in my community, just the amount of time that's being spent across searching for deals, researching products, reading reviews, unboxing, tracking packages, returning things, reselling things, it actually ends up to be, you know, quite a bit of time when you actually start looking at it, you know, holistically. So it's, you know, one, am I spending a lot of my precious time with this activity? Two, is this starting to impact my relationships in any way, whether that's, you know, a romantic relationship with a spouse or a partner, or it could even be other relationships that you have, you know, friendships, sibling relationships, parent relationships. Is it starting to negatively impact the relationships in my life and create tension within those relationships? And a big one that I see too is just, is it negatively impacting what I call your financial self-confidence? That's a big one for me. It's just when you're going out and telling yourself, like you're making plans for your money. So you're like, okay, I'm only going to spend this amount on whatever it is this month, right? I'm only going to spend $50 on Starbucks this month. And you end up spending $100 on Starbucks that month. Yes, of course, there's the component of that where you spent $50 more. So you have $50 less than you would have. But just the hit that that takes to your self-confidence of like, I can't do the things with my money that I say that I'm going to do with my money. And that really kind of gets you to the point where I call it like the screw it mindset, where you're just like, well, screw it. Like, there's just no point. Like, there's no point in trying. There's no point in making a plan. Like, I can't do it. So I might as well just do what I want and just spend myself into financial oblivion. So those are kind of like the really big ones. And then, of course, in your world, I know this one's big for you. I would say the fourth and final is taking a look at your environment and just saying, how does my environment feel? Does it feel heavy? Does it feel cluttered? Am I buying a lot of things that I'm not using? Or maybe I just use like once or twice. You know, I buy a new top. It still has the tags on it. It gets stuffed to the back of the closet. I might pull it out and wear it once or twice. But other than that, it's not getting much use, because the shopping is more about the experience. Like, it just becomes more about like, I just want to shop. I just want to buy something. I just want to get that dopamine hit from swiping my credit card. It could be anything that I'm buying. It could be a shirt. It could be a mug. It could be a planner. Like, it doesn't really matter what I'm buying. I just want to be buying something. And when we're in that mindset, we end up buying a lot of things that we don't use. Environments become very cluttered and heavy. So that's another one, is looking at your external environment and just saying, how does this feel? Like, do I have rooms and cabinets overflowing? And which I know you deal with a lot in your world. So that's another big indicator to me.
Definitely, definitely. And I think there's often also another issue that I suspect overlaps in my world and your world, which is if you're hiding your purchases from the people around you.
Yes.
I would see that as a warning sign.
Definitely. And, you know, I'll say that, you know, one thing I'll say is like, I came into doing this work because I actually used to have a big problem with being a compulsive shopper.
Okay.
About 10 years ago in my younger 20s. And that was one of the biggest things for me, because at the time I had just graduated from college and I had moved back in with my parents for a year. And so I was living with my parents, and that was kind of like one of the big light bulb moments to me, because I would go shop all the time. And then when I would come home, I would wait until I knew that they were either going to like be asleep, or they just weren't going to be home, to like bring in all my purchases. Or like, if I was having something delivered to the house, I would, you know, I'd get it and I'd snatch it in before they could see it. And so hiding your behavior is definitely a big one. I think with anything, right? Like, when you're getting to a point where you're hiding any sort of behavior, that's kind of a big, you know, red flag, so to speak, of like, okay, this is getting to a point where even I can recognize that it's getting out of control, so much so that I don't want other people to see the extent that it's gotten to.
There was a phenomenon a few years ago. I don't see it so much now, thankfully, but where people would share memes and it would be like an online sales page, and you could buy the thing for £10, or you could pay an extra £2 for the receipt to say something different to what you'd bought.
Oh.
So buy this necklace for £20, add an extra £2, and I'll write groceries on the receipt. Mm. And it was meant to be funny, but I just found it quite depressing and awful.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's something that I'm totally with you on that. And that's something that I feel like I see all the time, like whether we're talking about that specific example or just with like shopping culture in general. I just think that with the rise of social media, it's become so much more of a problem for people, but also with the rise in social media has also become, I feel like we don't take it as seriously, because I think it's like, it's just in our faces so much, just like the overconsumption and people just, you know, having 30 different Stanley mugs or, you know, 50 different body scrubs or whatever it is. Like, it's getting to a point where it feels more and more normal to us because of social media. And I think a big part of that is just to your point, like the meme culture, the, oh, haha, like my cute little shopping addiction. It's not a problem. It's no big deal. And I see it all the time in my world just because of what I do. And I'm with you. Every time I see it, I'm like, I don't necessarily, like, I know this is meant to be funny. I don't necessarily see it that way. But for anyone who's struggling with this, you obviously understand, like, it's not funny. It's not a joke. Like, the results of this can be, like, quite disastrous. And I think it just makes it that much harder for people to step forward and get help with this, to say, like, no, this is actually a problem for me. Like, it is actually negatively impacting my life in so many ways. But then you get on social media and everyone's like laughing about it and having, like, you know, making like jokes and puns about it, which, again, it's like we can all have a sense of humor, but also at the same time, it's like my lived experience of this is very different than that. Like, it's not funny and it's not cheeky and it doesn't feel good. So I think it's just something that is just part of our culture. Like, oh, haha, it's fun. It's cute to have a shopping addiction. Like, but in reality, it's not.
There's another parallel there in that people are really flippant, aren't they, about, oh, I'm such a shopping addict, in this, when they've been shopping, in the same way as someone will put a photo of a messy kitchen and say, I'm such a hoarder. And like you say, it's not that we're humorless or don't have a sense of humor, but it downplays the seriousness of what's going on for the people who read it, who have a real problem.
Yes. Yes. I would completely agree with you on that. And, you know, I'll say this. That's one of the things that I, when the women that come into my community, because I will say this, I mostly work with women. I will work with women and men, but I think that's another big thing, is like, this is primarily seen as a female issue. Again, like culturally, it's primarily seen as a female issue. And so even though like many studies have shown that, like, you know, men spend just as much, if not more, when they make impulse buys or impulse purchases, like this is just as much as of a problem for them in real life, they're much less likely to get help for it. Just again, because of the stigma around it, like, oh, only women struggle with this. And that comes kind of back to what you said about what I deem in my community as your spending self-concept, which is like, how do you see yourself when it comes to your spending and your buying and your acquiring? Because I think that that's just something that a lot of us like pick up along the way, especially women. Like, we just go through life being told, like, well, you're going to be the spender, and your male counterpart is going to be the saver, and you're going to be the one that's going to make, you know, stupid impulse buys and spend your money frivolously. And then your partner's going to be the one that's going to be responsible and who's going to rein you in and who's going to keep you on a budget and whatever. And a lot of this isn't like as obvious or blatant as that. Like, it's very kind of like, it's very subliminal. But a lot of us do. We come into adulthood with these self-concepts, like you said, of like, oh, well, I'm just a shopper. Oh, I'm just a spender. Oh, I'm just a hoarder. And that's one of the big pieces of work that I do in my community, like what you were saying at the beginning of the episode. Like, that's one of the first places you have to start, is what is my self-concept around this area, around how I spend money, around how I, you know, keep products and use products, because you're just with the way human psychology works, you're never going to be able to up-level your self-concept. It's just, your brain is always going to bring you back to whatever that self-concept is. And so it is a problem. It's a very big problem. And it's something that we don't even realize is there. And again, we just joke about it. We're like, oh, I'm just the shopper. Oh, I'm the spender. Oh, I'm the splurger. And again, it's like, we can all have a sense of humor about it, but I'm the one who's going to be like, whoa, 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 hold on. Like, let's think about this for a second and how that actually is impacting your spending habits, how that actually is impacting the way that you're buying and consuming things, because it does. And it's a big problem, to your point.
And even if the only way you ever socialize is going shopping with your friends.
Yeah.
Or if you're really lonely, but you know that the lady in the shop always has a nice chat with you, mm-hmm. or if you hate being in your home, and so you go out and there's nowhere really to go, so you go shopping.
Yep.
Spending is serving all of these purposes for you psychologically, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Like I did a post the other day that basically said something along the lines of, you know, going and spending a lot of your time shopping or, you know, buying a bunch of things online or whatever it is, it's actually very rarely about just having more stuff, right? Very, very rarely. Like, that's kind of what we think it's about on the surface. But if we start diving deeper, to your point, it could be about trying to regain a lost sense of control, right? I'll just run through a couple that I see a lot, right? Regaining a lost sense of control. So when something in your life is happening where it feels like, oh my gosh, things are out of control. I see this a lot when people lose their jobs, when you have a baby, when you move to a new town, when somebody in your life passes away, when a loved one passes away, when your life feels out of control, you try to regain a sense of that control through spending and buying, because that's just a very like tangible thing that you have control over. Like, we can control what we choose to spend our money on. To your point, this one was a big one for me when I was kind of in the throes of my shopping, is just trying to escape your life. And at that point in my life, I was working a job that I hated. I was working at a car dealership, of all things. I was selling cars, which, shocker, I hated. And so I would leave the dealership and I would go up to the mall and I would shop because I hated my job and I did not want to be there. And shopping was like the one light that I had in my day. And it was the way that I chose to kind of like escape my life, escape those like hard, difficult emotions of being in a job that I didn't like. It can be about perfectionism. I know a lot of people who struggle with perfectionism. They want to have the perfect house. They want to have the perfect wardrobe, the perfect skincare routine, the perfect makeup routine. Like, it has to be perfect. And so if you are a perfectionist, you might find that you try to achieve that perfection through going out and feeling like, okay, I have to have this and this and this and this and this. There's like a list in your head of all these things, all these boxes you have to check of like, I've got to have this, I've got to have this, I've got to have this. So to your point, the reasons why we do what we do with our money, specifically with our spending habits, it's so much more than just the stuff. And really getting to the root of understanding, like, what is this about? Like, why am I doing what I'm doing? Is it the perfectionism thing? Is it that I'm dysregulated? Is it that I'm trying to escape my emotions? Like, what is it for me? Do things feel out of control right now and I'm trying to regain a lost sense of that control? Understanding what that is can be such a powerful thing, because then you realize like, oh, that's what I'm after. It's not actually the stuff that I'm after. Like, that's what I'm after. And then we can start to work on that from there.
I make this podcast because I think it's important. I started it as an outlet for myself, but it's become much more than that. And I hear from people all the time about how listening to me talk about my experience and interview specialists and experts is helping them. Hearing those stories makes the time and cost absolutely worth it. But if you want to help to ensure that the future of the podcast is sustainable, you can donate to help with costs. To send a one-off or recurring donation, just go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/donate. Thank you. A lot of people, not just people who hoard, but I think a lot of people, often feel like we need to acquire stuff to do something. So we don't start going running, we buy all the running stuff. We don't start by learning to cook, we start by buying all the pots and pans and the recipe books.
Yes.
It's like we feel like the stuff gives us a particular identity when we could still have that identity without the stuff a lot of the time. How do you tackle this kind of thinking?
Yeah, so that's something that's called aspirational spending, which is so common. It's it's so common, but it's also so tricky because it, like, in the moment, it seems very virtuous, of course, right? When we're like, oh, I want to start the running. So I need to go out and I need to get the shoes and the watch and this, that. To your point, I want to start cooking more at home, but I need the pots and the pans and the recipe books and things like that. So we tend to convince ourselves, and I think this is just how consumer culture works, and this is the message that consumer culture sends us, is that stuff gives you an identity. Many of us have kind of been conditioned to believe, and this is actually something really interesting to do, is to actually start paying attention to the advertising that is served to you or that you're consuming, not necessarily evaluating what is the product that they're trying to sell me, but if you actually start evaluating one of two things, because this is what advertising is, and this is what we're always being sold. We're always being sold either an identity or a feeling. One of those two things. It's actually not about the product. And that's in advertising, that's what advertising tries to sell you. They're trying to either sell you the promise of a future identity that their product is going to give you, or the promise of a future emotional experience that they think that you want. And when you can understand that, like, oh, that's what I'm being sold. I'm not being sold the pots and pans. I'm not being sold the running shoes. I'm being sold being a healthy person, having the identity of a healthy person. It really does kind of change the way that you evaluate your purchases. But because of that, we have become conditioned to say, like, oh, well, if I want to have this identity, or if I want to feel this certain way that I want to feel, then the products are what are going to give that to me. Like, we've just been conditioned to link those two things, like products to identities, products to how I feel. So anytime we want to, like, start something new, that's the first thing we do. The first thing we do is we always go, what do I need? What do I need to get? What do I need to buy? Right? And then we'll go out and we'll spend all the money and we'll buy all the things. And something that I hear a lot, kind of like the justification, I guess you could say, is people will say, well, if I go out and I invest in this new hobby, or if I invest in this new thing, it'll, like, keep me motivated to do the thing, to keep cooking or to keep running or whatever. But from what I've seen with myself and with thousands of the women in my community, it never works that way. Like, you always end up just, like, burning yourself out 2 weeks later, and 2 weeks later, you're completely off of it and on to the next thing. And so it's kind of like evaluating, like, okay, well, why is that? And it's because when you understand the identity is what I'm after, the emotional experience is what I'm after, the products aren't going to give you that. The products, what I always say is, the products can help you enhance an identity that you are working to build, but they're not step one. So what I always say in my community, and I said this on the Financial Confessions podcast too, is, like, my big rule is give yourself the proof before you go and make the purchase. So sticking with this running example, it's like, okay, if you want to become someone who runs, most of the time we have what we need to just go outside and start running. Like, most of us have a pair of sneakers, even if they're old and have holes in them, whatever. Like, most of us have a pair of shoes that we can at least go outside and either walk or run in, and something that we can wear, right? Even if it's an old ratted up shirt with a bunch of holes in it. And so my thing is, like, let's prove to ourselves for at least 30 days that we are going to stick with this, that it's something that we like, that it's something that has longevity, and we think that we're going to continue, because the running is what's going to give you the identity as a runner, right? Like, that's what you're after. You want the identity of a runner, and it's like, well, guess what's going to give that to you? Running. Like, going outside or getting on a treadmill and running. It's not the shoes. It's not the watch. It's not the Lulu set. That stuff can come later on if you want it to. Like, I'm not saying that it can't, but like I said, it doesn't need to be step one. And that's where most of us go first, is like,
yeah,
right out of the gate. What do I need, or what do I need to buy?
And if you buy the stuff before you've run 100 yards, you don't know what you're going to need.
Yes.
I feel like you might run for 30 days and go, these old shoes are brilliant. They're really comfy and they do the job. That's fine. And the Clever Watch, I'm not really interested in how many calories I've burnt, but I'd really like to track the location. Whereas before you start running, you don't know. So you buy it all.
Yeah. And I think we just like, I think we get uncomfortable, and you can see this in so many areas of life. Like whether we're talking about aspirational spending with like a hobby or an activity that we want to start. I see this a lot. I'll give you a couple other examples that I see a lot is like when we move into maybe like a new apartment or a new home or something like that, we just have this tendency as human beings to want things to be complete. Like we don't like things to be like partially done or to be like partially complete. Like there's something about it that just mentally is uncomfortable to us. And so we want to move into the new apartment and we want to furnish it all at once. Like we don't want there to be gaps or holes or things missing or whatever. But to your point, giving yourself time to live in either like a new season, to like live in the new apartment or the new house, to try the hobby for a certain amount of time, you're going to learn so much in that period of time about what you actually need and what you actually want and what you actually like. Because I know many people listening have probably experienced this in some form. It's like when you do jump out of the gate really quickly and you're like, okay, I'm going to furnish the entire apartment. 6 months down the road, you're like, I hate this. Like, I don't even like any of this anymore. I jumped and I bought all this stuff to furnish it because I didn't want it to be incomplete. But now that I've actually lived in here for 6 months, I don't like any of this. Like, I would do it so differently if I was to redo this today. So it happens a lot, but you're completely right. Like, that's why waiting and just living life in a new season, whether we're talking about a new house or you've had a baby, or, you know, you started a new job and you think you have to go out and buy a completely new wardrobe, right? That's what I did.
We've all done it. We've all done it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just we can all find areas where we've done this. And then shortly afterwards, we've gone, oh, well, I wish I would have given myself some time to actually figure out what this was actually going to be like before I went out and spent all this money and bought all this stuff that now I realize I don't want or need.
I remember being at university and I kind of thought that if I bought the books, that was as good as reading them. Like I'd done my bit by buying them and was quite resentful when I then had to read them as well, and that just possessing them wasn't enough.
Yeah.
I've heard you talk about having an urge jar. Can you explain what that is and what it does?
Yeah. Yeah. So the other kind of big part or component of my work is working within the emotional component of buying and shopping and spending. And a big part of that is just being able to sit with and allow what I call the urge to splurge, which is something that has become really, really hard for many of us to do in 2024, again, because of the world that we live in. Whether we're talking about you see something on social media that is immediately available to you within a couple of clicks, or Amazon, you can buy something and have it delivered to you the next day, or whatever it is, we have just become primed for instant gratification. And because of that, many of us have gotten just into a habit loop of see it, want it, buy it. So the second we see something and the second that desire hits us to have that thing, to own that thing, we go and we spend the money and we buy the thing. There's no, I call it the three D's, right? There's the distance between the desire and the decision.
Okay.
And what we want is we want that distance between those two things, between the initial desire and the decision to buy it. We want there to be a healthy amount of distance between those two things, right? And what's started to happen with so many of us is that distance has basically become non-existent, right? It's like desire, decision. Like I see something I want, I decide to buy it. What an urge jar is it's a physical tool and a visual representation of you giving yourself distance between the things that you see that you want to buy and actually making the decision to buy them. So what you need to make an urge jar, and again, do not go out and buy anything new for this. I promise you have exactly what you need already. You don't need to spend any money on this. You just need two containers, whether we're talking about, you know, two cups, two mason jars, whatever, just find two containers. And then you also need 100 of any item. So it could be paper clips, marbles, beans, just again, Legos, like find something around your house that you have 100 of. And you're going to start with all 100 items in one container. And every single time that you see something that you want to buy, instead of immediately going and buying it, what you're going to do is you're going to sit with the urge to splurge, which, yes, is uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to do, especially if you've gotten into the rhythm of not doing that, of not sitting with the urge and being with the urge. But typically, the urge isn't going to last as long as you think it's going to last. Like, and I think a lot of us kind of get to the point where we make this urge to want to get something or buy something kind of like the monster under our bed. We're like, oh my gosh, it's so bad. It's so heavy. It's so uncomfortable. But when you actually are just with the urge, when you're patient with the urge, when you take some deep breaths, when you regulate, the urge is probably going to last maybe like 10 minutes tops. And after you've sat with an urge for about 10 minutes, you're just going to take one trinket from one jar and you're going to move it to the other. And every time you go through this process, you're just going to move one to the other, one to the other, because there's something about accumulation that the human brain really likes. The human brain also really likes to see progress being made. So like, it's kind of cool to see like, okay, I'm moving trinkets from one to the other. And then what I also think is a really kind of fun and cool extra step that you can take, which I always have the women in my community do this, is every time you do that, log what it was that you were going to buy. So you can say, I was going to buy this $60 pair of shoes, but I sat with the urge and I didn't buy them. So I'm going to log that. And every like 10 urges, you're going to do this 100 times. Every 10 urges, total it up and see how much you would have spent, but you didn't. And so it's basically like a visual representation of all of the money that you would have spent impulsively or that you would have overspent, but you didn't. And I say, look, you can total it up and you can just see what that number is and just be like, oh my gosh, that's crazy, and just kind of move on. I also have women in my community who every 10 urges, they'll total it up and then they'll do something else with that money. They'll move it into savings. They'll put it towards a credit card payment. They'll use it for like a more aligned purchase, right? Like something that they know that they're actually going to get long-term fulfillment and enjoyment out of. Like I had a client who did this. She went through all 100 of her urges. She ended up taking her family on like a luxury vacation.
Wow.
from all the money that she would have spent but didn't. So you can do it either way. You can just say like, oh, that's cool. Like I would have spent all this money, but I'm just going to leave it in my account. Or you can choose to say like, okay, and now I'm going to choose to do this with it. But I always say like your first 1 to 20 urges are going to be the hardest, the most uncomfortable. It's going to stink a little bit, especially like if you're, again, if you're in that pattern of see it, want it, buy it, see it, want it, buy it, it's going to be uncomfortable. But what you'll start to realize is like what we're doing here is we're just forming a new habit loop. Right now, you're just in the habit of see it, want it, buy it. We're getting you through doing this 100 times. You're practicing putting distance between the desire and the decision. And that takes practice. It's just like anything. Like you're not just going to like wake up one day and be like, oh, okay, well, I'm just going to completely change how I do this now, and it's going to feel great and it's going to feel amazing. It's just like changing or forming any other habit. But the urge jar is just a really good visual, tangible tool to help you do that, to help you keep progress. And it's also fun. Like it gives you something to do. It gives you a hit of dopamine. It's cool to see your little trinkets move and just to see how much money you're not spending that you would have in the past.
Another benefit of the logging aspect of it is reminds me of something I do, which is I have a spreadsheet so that if I am saving up for something, I can write that thing and how much it costs. And then at the end of each month, I try and put a certain amount aside so then I can see how close I am to being able to buy the thing, or whether I can, or whether I need to save a bit more. And a real benefit of that is the things I add to the spreadsheet that I'm saving up for that I desperately want. When I go back to the spreadsheet, I look at a lot of those things and go, why was I so bothered about that? The moment has passed and I'm not interested anymore. Whereas if I just bought it straight away, it would still be in my house.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so common. Like, I have something similar. I call mine a things I want to buy list, where whenever I see something that I want to buy, like if I see something on social media, let's say, I'll snap a picture of it and I will add it to my, I have an album on my phone called Things I Want to Buy. Or if I'm in a store, I'll just snap a picture of it. But that's the beauty of giving yourself distance, because whenever you see something that you want to buy, what's happening from just a psychological perspective is your brain is being flooded with dopamine. Your prefrontal cortex is essentially shutting down, which is kind of like the logical part of your brain where you were like logic and reason and forward thought lies. The pleasure systems start to activate. Even when we're talking about things like being on sale or being discounted, right? When you see like, ooh, something's super heavily discounted or this is a really good deal. The amygdala, the part of your brain that controls your fear responses, like it's the same part of your brain that would activate if you were being chased by a bear, activates. So that's what's going on, like when you see something that you want to buy. And I always say, like, that is not the brain space that we want to be making our purchasing decisions from, because it's just not a logical mindset to be in. And that's when you, to your point, that's when you end up buying things that you're like, I don't want this. I used it once. I'm not excited about it anymore. And the same thing is true for me. Like when I put things on my things I want to buy list, I would say maybe like half the stuff that I end up putting on there, I don't actually end up buying, because when I go back to revisit it, the same thing happens to me. I go, oh, okay, well, my brain just got a little hyper about that in the moment. But like, I don't, like now that I have some space from this, I don't actually want this thing anymore. So it's crazy, like the benefits of what waiting will do. Like it gives your brain time to cool off, to come back into that more logical space. You'll find that you're buying things that you're actually using and liking and valuing. Like there's just so many benefits to it.
And also, I think that I'll be interested to hear whether you agree, but I think that if, say, I see a book that sounds really interesting and I want to buy it, I can add it to my cart on whatever website I'm on, but adding it to the spreadsheet or going on my library website and adding it to my request list, or even adding it to my wish list instead of my cart, seem to do not quite the same thing to my brain, but 80% of that kind of hit I still get.
Yeah. Well, the reason for that is, and again, this varies person to person, okay? So like, just keep that in mind. Like, it's not the same for every person, but one of the main reasons for that is because dopamine, which is the main neurotransmitter that we're after, right? That's kind of like the feel-good neurotransmitter that gets released that we're so often chasing. Dopamine is actually what they call the anticipation molecule. So you actually get more dopamine released in anticipation of something than you do with the actual event of it. So another example of this is they did a study that showed that people actually get more pleasure from the period of time leading up to a vacation than they actually do from the vacation itself, right? Because they're like, it's kind of like that period of time beforehand that you get to like relish in what's to come. For me personally, I actually love Christmas Eve day so much more than I love Christmas Day. Like Christmas Eve day is like so much better to me than like actual Christmas Day. And again, that speaks to what we really want is the anticipation of something. And so that's why this tool and just having a list, whether you have like a tangible list elsewhere or you're just adding things to your cart and then not actually like following through and not actually purchasing them, oftentimes, and again, like I said, it varies person to person, but for a lot of people, it gives them enough, like it scratches the itch enough to where they're like, okay, I'm good.
Yeah.
Right? Because you do get a hit of dopamine. You do get a hit of dopamine when you're adding something into your cart or when you're adding something onto a things I want to buy list or a wish list or something similar, because you're getting to relish in the anticipation of it. So it's basically you saying it's not a no forever. It's just a not right now. And there will come a day, whether that day is a couple days from now, or maybe it's a couple weeks or a couple months from now, but like there will come a day where if I want to buy this thing and I want to have this thing, I can. That's just not going to be like right now in this moment.
Yeah. Something I've talked on this podcast about a lot is the fear of scarcity. In people who hoard, this can lead people to acquire all kinds of unnecessary things to ease that anxiety. What is your advice when a fear of scarcity is what's tempting somebody to overspend?
Yeah, that's such a good question. Scarcity spending, that's kind of what I call it, because again, it's a very real thing. And I see this most often with either things being on sale, or I also see this a lot with like thrifting, where we're kind of talking about like once, you know, it's like a once in a lifetime find, right? Where it's like, or something's going to go out of stock or whatever.
That is absolutely my ultimate downfall without is a question. It? Yeah.
So here's kind of my, what I always recommend people to just do and try. I think firstly, just having a baseline awareness over what is happening in my brain isn't actually like, it's not matched to the actual threat in real life. Okay. And that sounds very like simplistic, but I think it is important to recognize that, because when you are in that moment, like let's just say we go thrifting. Okay. We go thrifting. We find something that's like one of a kind, but let's just say it's like super expensive, or like we know we can't afford it, or we know it would kind of put us in a financial predicament down the road. But your brain is, again, kind of in that moment, like going haywire. It actually is helpful in that moment to take a couple of deep breaths, because you would actually be surprised at like what just a couple of like very deep breaths will do to help you kind of like cool off your brain. And also just recognizing like my brain is trying to tell me that if I don't get this thing, that like I'm literally going to die. Like that's how it feels to me in this moment, truly. And it's not dramatic to say that, because anyone who's ever lived through that, like it actually can feel that way. It's like, if I feel like if I don't get this thing and like somebody else gets it, that like I feel threatened. I feel like I'm going to die. Like it feels really scary. And so reminding yourself like in that moment, like something that I tell the women in my community to say a lot is like, I am safe. Like it will be okay if I don't get this thing. And recognizing that the worst case scenario here, like sometimes I just like to play out worst case scenario. What's worst case scenario? Worst case scenario is you don't get it and somebody else gets it. That's worst case scenario. Which then you ask yourself, okay, well, what's the worst part about that? And the worst part about any situation or any worst case scenario situation is simply just an emotion. That's it. Like worst case scenario is you having to feel an emotion, whether that emotion is disappointment, whether it's regret. I mean, I don't know if you have any that like stick out to you, but like disappointment, deprivation, regret.
Yeah, I think the regret is a big one. I have a regular guest on the podcast, Dr. Jan Eppingstall, who is a therapist who works with people who hoard specifically. Mm. And she found research that said that people who hoard have a stronger anticipation of regret than most people. So I suspect that's, I know for me that is, I will feel, oh, if I go home without this, I'll really regret it. And I suspect for a lot of people listening, that's a thing.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like the thing that we have to do, and even, and listen, I'm not saying you have to do this every time, but I am saying just allow yourself to experience it either one time, like start with one time, or multiple times if you can, but just allowing yourself to practice feeling regret. And because that's another thing with emotions, like just practicing feeling regret and just showing yourself like, I can feel regret. I'm not saying it feels good and I'm not saying it feels great. And we don't have to, you know, put lipstick on a pig and act like this is like, you know, fun or enjoyable, but also at the same time, like I am capable of feeling it and experiencing it. And if I simply let it come and pass, it will dissipate, right? Like eventually the regret will pass and dissipate. And again, for some people, that period of time varies. And again, I think it depends on what we're talking about, like the person and the situation and what we're talking about. But one thing I do know to be true is that it will dissipate eventually, right? It will dissipate. And so you have to just practice. Like what I have the women in my community do is practice feeling the emotions. So I'm like, if thrifting is your thing, like if that's kind of your thing or your downfall, or bargain hunting or bargain shopping or whatever it is, it's kind of like exposure therapy. I'm like, I want you to go into the thrift store and I want you to go in there deciding ahead of time that you're not going to buy anything and you're not going to spend any money. No matter what you see, no matter what you find, we're going to go in and we're not going to spend any money. And chances are you're going to go in there and you're going to find something that you want to buy and you're going to leave without it and you're going to feel regret. And be with that regret. Like, what does that regret feel like?
Yeah, and then you will survive feeling regret.
Exactly.
The other thing that I find increasingly helpful is remembering that I might feel regret if I don't buy it, but if I do buy it, I might well have a different kind of regret.
Yeah.
I might get it home and realize there's nowhere to put it and I've already got three of them, and then have a regret a different thing. It's not like buying it means no unpleasant emotions in the future. It's just replacing one regret for another.
You're so right. Yeah. And that's such an important point to make, because I believe that emotions are never a matter of if, but when. And so you're completely right. It's like, I think as human beings, we are just primed to try to look for choices, decisions, or solutions to where the uncomfortable emotion doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So we're like, where's the choice or where's the path or decision where like, I just won't feel the regret at all, or I just won't feel the deprivation at all. But when you can actually have the light bulb moment where you realize like the regret or the deprivation or the disappointment, it's actually not a matter of will I feel this, but it's a matter of when will I feel this? It really can be this like light bulb moment that changes the way that you approach your decisions. Because to your point, it's like, yes, I might feel regret over not buying this product, but if I do buy it and I get home and I realize, to your point, I don't have anywhere to put it and I overspent, like I'm going to feel regret over it. Or I don't want to feel disappointment about not getting it. But when I, again, I've made all these choices that I don't love, I'm going to feel disappointed in myself. So it's like, to your point, the emotions will be a little bit of a different flavor, but you're still going to feel the regret. You're still going to feel the disappointment or the deprivation. It's just like, it's always waiting for you. So when you can kind of evaluate like, okay, not will I feel this, but when do I want to feel it? And what do I want to feel it about? What flavor of this do I want to feel it about? Do I want to feel it about the purchase or the product? Or often after the fact, do I want to feel it about me?
Yeah.
Like, do I want to be disappointed that I didn't get the product, or do I want to be disappointed in myself because I made a choice that I knew was out of integrity with myself? And so I'm so glad that you said that, because that's like, that's such a huge realization to have, is like, there really is no situation where you can avoid the emotions. And that's why I'm such a big proponent of like, kind of like the exposure to it, like just expose yourself to it. Cause it's going to happen either way. Like, there's no situation where you can avoid this. So you might as well just expose yourself to it, get it out of the way, be done with it. And then you can move on. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people seem to go from, I am spending too much, to therefore I will buy nothing at all for 3 months. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I can see that it's easier to say no spending than some controlled spending, because we like that black and white.
Yeah.
And finding where the line is can be really difficult. But when an approach is that extreme, I always worry that at the end of that 3 months, they will splurge and be really out of control. What is your take on that kind of all or nothing solution?
Yeah. You know, I know I've kind of said this a lot in this episode, but I really do think that it's highly dependent on the individual. But I will give you some things just to kind of think about, right? I'm actually not like a huge proponent of it. You know, they're called no spend challenges, right? I guess kind of what we call them. And I actually, a lot of people are surprised to hear that I'm not like a huge proponent of them. And I don't encourage them very often in my community, because to your point, I think that oftentimes they're done in a way that's not super helpful. And it just leads to the individual bouncing back even harder, like when, once it's over, and like going like being even worse than they were before they started the no spend challenge, before they started it. But to your point, I think that with people, sometimes you have people who are abstainers and sometimes you have people who are moderators. And I think that you have to take into account, like, you know, who am I as an individual, my temperament, my personality, what's easier for me? Like, is it easier for me to just say, like, I'm just not going to spend or do anything at all? Or is it just easier for me to say, like, I'm going to give myself $50 or 50 pounds a week and I can spend that on whatever I want, but I'm not going to go past that. And just kind of giving yourself like a little bit of a taste of it. But I'll say this. So I think it's one, deciding what works best for me. What type of person am I? If you are in the abstainer category, to where you are going to say like, okay, I'm going to do a no spend challenge. I'm not going to buy anything but like absolute necessities for a month or for 90 days or whatever it is. Just a couple of things to kind of keep in mind that I think are important. I think that if you go through a period like that and the whole time you're focused on getting to the end, and you're really focused on all the stuff that you can't have during that time, and all of the stuff that you are wanting to buy the second that it's over, if you catch yourself in that mindset, I think that the no spend challenge will be doing more damage than good for you. And that might be a key indicator to you that you actually might be better just giving yourself a certain amount of money to spend on whatever it is every week or every month or whatever it is. Because that's the situation where when it's over and you kind of take those chains off of yourself, you're going to go buck wild and spiral. I think if you're going to do it, one of the best things that you can do is use it as an opportunity to really rediscover all of the good and the beauty and the value and the richness that you already have in your life, right? And you can do, I'll say this, you can do a no spend challenge for everything. So like what a lot of people do is they'll say like, I'm not going to buy anything unless it's an absolute essential or necessity. And I also have, I've also seen people do it with specific categories. Like, I'm not going to buy clothes for a certain amount of time, or I'm not going to buy, I don't know, kitchen utensils or kitchen or like anything for my kitchen for a certain amount of time. So you can do it either way. But let's just stick with the clothes example. Let's just say you're like, I'm not going to buy any new clothes for 6 months. Well, the whole time, if you're simply just focused on, oh my gosh, those shoes are so cute. Oh my God, that blazer. Oh my God, that top. Oh my God, that dress. Oh my God, oh my God. Like, that's just, it's going to be so painful for you. And I kind of call it like destructive desire. It's like having desire for something and it feeling bad and almost painful because you've like told yourself, like, I can't have that. Right. Versus, okay, I'm not going to buy any clothes for 6 months and I'm going to rediscover my closet. I'm going to rediscover my wardrobe. I'm going to make a challenge to myself to come up with 10 new outfits, 20 new outfits that I never envisioned before because my default was always just to go out and buy more, 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 more. So I'm going to go and actually like rediscover that. So I think if you are going to, again, I think it really depends on the person and individual, but if you are going to do it, really use it as a period of time to rediscover what you already have, because that's the coolest part about it, right? Is when you're like, oh my gosh, like I do have a lot of really good stuff. I do have a lot of really great pieces. Like I totally forgot I had this, like, right? Like that's yeah. So fun. And that feels, in my opinion, even better than going out and buying something new.
Definitely shop your own stuff. And I think I can see the benefit as a kind of, if you're really entrenched in a pattern, I can see that a week might break the pattern.
Yes.
But when it's more extended, it always makes me think of before I got to the point where I realized that diets don't work, in the days when I was still dieting, I was doing this particular diet, and for months, literally months, all I could think about was chocolate brownie cheesecake. It's not even my favorite kind of cheesecake, but for some reason that was my fixation for months yeah. and months and months. I would literally lie in bed at night thinking about chocolate brownie cheesecake. And eventually, when I stopped dieting, I was like, it is time for chocolate brownie cheesecake. Yeah. And I had chocolate brownie cheesecake and it was fine.
Uh-huh.
But it was not wow. It was not the best thing I've ever eaten. It was just fine. But because I hadn't been allowed it, I'd obsessed about it for months.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that definitely says something, right? Because I think that's kind of what I was saying. Like, if you're going to go through it and view it as, well, I can't have these things because I've just told myself that I can't.
Yeah.
Right? Versus like, this is simply just like a choice that I've made. Like, I'll give you a current example for me in my life, right? I made the decision this year in 2024 to stop drinking any alcohol. And I don't think I'll do it like forever for like the rest of my life, but I just kind of got to the point with alcohol where I was just like, it just felt like it was doing more bad, like damage to me than benefiting me. So I went into this year being like, okay, I'm going to try to go a whole year without drinking any alcohol. But here's the biggest part for me, because it's actually been quite easy for me, at least for the first month of this year. And when I kind of think about like why that is, because I was kind of worried about it. I was kind of worried like, oh gosh, is this going to be hard? Like, am I going to feel like restricted or deprived or whatever? And to be honest, I haven't. And I think the biggest reason for that is because I'm not being super like strict on myself of like, absolutely under no circumstances, like, are you to have a drink of alcohol? Like, I'm more so of the mindset of this is something that I'm choosing to do because I feel like I would just prefer it. I feel like it would serve me better than drinking. And also I know that I can change my mind at any time. Like if I want to change my mind at any time, I can. And so I think because I've had, like, yes, it is a version of completely abstaining from something, but also at the same time, I'm not being super like strict and hard on myself, which actually has made it so much easier.
Definitely.
Than being like, no, 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 no. Because to your point, I think if I was like, no, 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 then all I'd be thinking about is wine. Like, I want to get to the end of the day so I can have some wine, you know, but it just hasn't been the case for me. And I think it's just because I'm like, being more easy on myself than hard on myself about it.
Yeah, it makes me think of, I don't know if this is international, but here quite a lot of people do Dry January, where after Christmas and New Year, people just need to give their livers a break. Yeah. And so quite a lot of people do Dry January. And then some of those people realize that they feel loads better and they can remember their nights out and they can wake up for work and all of these things. And then it gets to February and they go, I think I'm going to carry this on.
Yeah, yeah, and exactly. That,
then it's become a positive choice rather than something they're not allowed to do. And I think that is a really big difference, isn't it?
Oh, it's such a big difference. Yeah. Because it's almost like when you're in the mindset of like, I'm not allowed to do this thing. It's like a little kid. It's like when you tell a little kid, like, you can't go into this room in the house, or you can't go over here, or you can't have this thing. Like, of course, what is the little kid going to do? It's all they're going to want to do because you've told them that they can't do it. And it's brought all the attention to it versus just being like, listen, we're just going to like direct our attention elsewhere. Like, this is just a choice that we've made, but we can change our minds at any time. And then to your point, you do get to a point where you're like, wait, like, I like this. I like not drinking. Like, the cheesecake is okay, but like, I'm also okay without it. Or like, I don't need to be buying all of this stuff. Like, I actually prefer it so much more this way. Like, it feels better this way. When you can make a shift into a new set of behaviors that way versus like, I'm not going to do it, right? And putting those chains on yourself, I actually think it's such a more natural and sustainable way to go about it.
Yeah. Since I added graphs to my budgeting spreadsheet, I find that when I see the graph go up, that gives me a kick when I can see that there's more in my savings than there was last month.
Yeah.
I'm trying to kind of learn to get my kick there instead.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I did want to sound you out, actually, on budgeting apps, budgeting websites, budgeting, that kind of thing. I had never really done anything with them until last year when I was broke and I wasn't sure why.
Yeah.
So I set myself up on You Need a Budget. And I didn't get on very well with the interface or with a lot of it. But what I did find useful was that having to account for every transaction meant that I could understand where my money was going. I didn't find it useful to set parameters or to set goals, but I did find it useful just to go, oh, I do spend more on that than I thought I did.
Yeah.
What's your take on that kind of budgeting setup?
Well, I'll say this. I've actually been a user of YNAB, You Need a Budget, for many, many years. It's actually what I use to budget. And I'm a big fan of it. But to your point, I'm kind of the same as you in that it's mostly for me about the transparency of understanding, like, okay, where is my money actually going? Like, how much are we actually spending on groceries? How much are we actually spending on dining out or clothing or like things for my daughter or things like that? Because I think when you're not tracking it, which YNAB or and honestly, any budgeting software will do this nowadays, mostly they'll link it to your accounts and either pull it through or you can just input it manually if you're more comfortable with that. But most budgeting softwares will give you that level of transparency, which I think is huge. And for me, I think another big kind of like useful component of it, you know, especially being self-employed and, you know, my income source is a little bit different all of the time.
Sure.
It is helpful for planning purposes, just to say like, what do I need to pay our mortgage? What do I need to pay our insurance and our water bill and things like that? And, you know, just making sure that we have enough to pay all of those things and, you know, making sure like, okay, on average, this is what we spend on groceries. And on average, this is what we spend for my daughter. And just kind of making sure, like, do we have enough, right? In terms of like what I'm paying myself. But even if you're not self-employed, You know, and you just get, you know, a regular paycheck from work or whatever it is. It's still useful in that sense, just to have transparency and also just for planning.
The other thing I found really useful was that it made me do something that it was one of those tasks that I always knew I should do and never did. It was working out those things that you might pay for once a year. Mm. Say my car insurance. My car insurance is due soon, and I'm going to have to pay a certain amount in one go. And setting myself up on YNAB did make me finally go, okay, so it's going to be roughly that much. If I divide that by 12, how much should I put aside so that every February it isn't a big, oh God, moment?
Yes. Yeah. And that's something that, like, in my YNAB, for instance, I like to lump everything together instead of having like an individual line item for every single thing, right? But I have a line item in my budget that I just call annual subscriptions. So anything that I have to pay annually for, I don't pay my insurance annually. I pay it every month. But like, for instance, like my Amazon Prime membership, I pay for that every year. Or like my AAA, like roadside assistance, I think I pay like, you know, $70 or something like that every single year. But to your point, the thing is like when you have like several things like that, it can be really frustrating, like going into a month and being like, well, shoot, I totally forgot that I have to pay for that this month, because then that's going to like that takes from this. And now I don't have as much for that or whatever. And that's where I kind of call it like the money roller coaster, where you get on this, like what feels like a roller coaster of like some months you have these big expenses and other months you don't. And so but then on the months you don't, you're like, woohoo. And then you spend everything and you're like not being proactive about what's to come. And then the months that you do have more, it's like, shoot, like now so it's like it creates this whole mess. And to your point, like what I do is I just have a list of all of my annual expenses. I total them all up. I divide that by 12 so that every single month I know like, okay, I need to set aside X amount, and that's going to cover all of my annual expenses all year. So when I do have like, when I do have to pay for my Amazon Prime or my AAA, I know that I have the money there, and it's not this like, oh shoot, what am I going to do? Or that stinks because that now I have to pull this money from elsewhere. I'm ready and I'm prepared for it. And to your point, YNAB is, or most budgeting softwares are really helpful with helping you do that.
Yeah. I now have a specific bank account just for that. So
yeah, that's smart. Yeah.
All of those annual expenses, I put a set amount, like you were saying, every month in there. So then when, you know, something big, and it just, I feel less out of control that way, which feels great.
Yeah. And that's one of the biggest things, is just like managing your money in a way that's going to make you feel more in control. Because that's one of the worst feelings. One of the worst feelings ever is to feel like you're out of control with your money. And that kind of goes back to like the screw it mindset I was saying earlier, because I feel like once one domino falls, it can be really easy to get into the mindset of like, well, like, might as well just spend the rest, or might as well just who cares? Why try? Right. So it's like once that first domino falls, it can be really easy to just have the rest kind of fall. Yeah. And so anything that you can do to like plan ahead, be proactive, set the money aside, and even just like taking the time to pull up your last 12 months of bank statements and just going through them and say, and highlighting like, okay, well, what are the things that I have to pay for annually, or maybe quarterly, or maybe semi-annually? Like, what are those things? And instead of just being surprised about them every year, because they're really not a surprise, but it's like they are, but they're not, right? But instead of being like, oh shoot, it's February, I have to pay my Amazon Prime. It's like, how different does it feel going into February being like, yeah, I have to pay my Amazon Prime and I'm ready. I've got the money sitting right here. It's a totally different dynamic that just makes you feel so much more in control. And it's such a more empowering place to approach your money from.
Absolutely. Paige, that has been so interesting and genuinely useful. So I really appreciate you coming on. If people want to find you online, where can they do so?
Yeah. So the best place, I'm most active on Instagram and TikTok. My handles are at overcoming_overspending on both of those. And like you said, I also have a podcast of my own. It's called the Money Love Podcast. So you can add that into your podcast lineup in addition to this amazing one. And I think the last place, which is more so if you would like to work together and actually work and come and join my community, I have an online membership. It's called the Overcoming Overspending Membership. And you just pay monthly. So you come and you pay every single month and you can stay as long as you want or as short as you want. But that's where you're going to get my whole process. We do live coaching in there. We meet 10 to 12 times every single month and do live coaching on Zoom. So you can get a lot of support and individualized attention in there. And it's also just a community of people who are struggling with this, right? Like they're struggling with overspending, they're struggling with their spending habits, but they're actually in a place where they're like, I'm ready to do something about it. So it's the best place, in my opinion, to do the work in. So come join us if you're ready for that. You just go to overcomingoverspending.com.
Amazing. And I will link to all of those from the website at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding, all the overcoming on this call.
Yeah, I love it.
But Paige, thank you. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Let's talk secrets. I keep my hoarding secret, and I often wonder about the effect that these secrets and this shame have on us and on mental health. To start breaking the taboo, I want to hear your hoarding secrets to discuss anonymously on the podcast. I've created a form to submit your secrets anonymously. I won't know who sends what. If you want to tell me your secret for a potential future episode, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/secret.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support. 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way, so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code ACAST to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
And shout out this week to Mark Asquith on the podcast Accelerator podcast. He is talking here about things you might buy from like marketing gurus, but honestly, it applies to every kind of sale. Have a listen.
Only buy something that you feel is a bargain if you're going to use it to its full extent, and if you're going to do that right now. If not, it isn't a bargain. And there'll be another sale from the same person this time next year. You didn't miss a damn thing. Save your money.
I will link to Mark's podcast Accelerator in the show notes. But yeah, we all need to remember that a bit better, I think. Okay, thank you for listening, and I will speak to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at That Hoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder. To find out more about how you can support the podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support. And do subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. There may be links in this podcast that earn me money. This doesn't come at any extra cost to you if you ever make a purchase through the links, and it helps to support the future of the podcast.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Kim Holderness.
And I'm Ben Holderness.
We host the Holderness Family Podcast every Tuesday.
You may know us from the silly videos that we make online.
Or a book about marriage called Everybody Fights.
Or as winners of season 33 of The Amazing Race.
Still can't believe that happened. Yeah. Listen, we do a lot of stuff, but our podcast is our most favorite thing.
Yeah, because every week we get to sit down face to face, talk to each other about marriage, family, mental health, or just anything that we want to know more about.
Sometimes we have expert interviews, sometimes it's just us, but our goal is to bring some joy and laughter and to your life every week.
Our other goal is that maybe you will learn something as well.
Right. So search the Holderness Family Podcast and check out our most recent episodes. We have one about staying organized with creators of the Home Edit.
And one about being diagnosed with ADHD as an adult.
We hope you'll join us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.